From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Bill Nell joins us. Our UFO extravaganza, along with the paranormal, should be a fascinating program. Russia will be forced to make military responses if the United States Czech missile defense agreement is ratified. That's what the Russians say. The statement came hours after U.S. and Czech officials reached an initial agreement on deploying elements of a missile defense system in the Eastern European country. Russia says the system would severely undermine European security balances by weakening Russia's missile capacity. If the agreement is ratified, this is what they say, we will be forced to react not with diplomatic, but with military technical methods. It did not give specifics of what that response would entail. Iraqi officials have stepped up pressure on us to agree to a specific timeline to withdraw American forces. It is a sign of the government's growing confidence as violence fails and begins to drop even more. The tough words come as the Bush administration is running out of time to reach a needed troop deal before the U.S. election in November and the president's last months in office. Some type of agreement is required to keep American troops in Iraq after a U.N. mandate expires on December 31st. The Iraqi timeline proposal made public Tuesday appears that U.S. forces to fully withdraw 5 years after the Iraqis take the lead on security nationwide, though the precondition could itself take years. We're going to be in Iraq for a long time. Drug safety officials imposed the government's most urgent safety warning on Cipro and similar antibiotics, citing evidence that they might lead to tendon ruptures, a serious injury that can lead patients incapacitated and needing extensive surgery. The Food and Drug Administration has ordered makers of these drugs, a potent class of antibacterials, to add a prominent black box warning to their products and develop new literature for patients emphasizing the risks. Tendon ruptures are normally thought of as sports injuries, and they don't know why some of these antibiotics might affect the tendon, but they want the warnings out there. A 44-year-old man died after drinking 9.6 liters of water in 8 hours, the equivalent of 4.5 soda bottles. Andrew Thornton of England was drinking the cold water to relieve his sore gums, which were brought on by gum disease. He drank the water to avoid taking painkillers, said his mother. After he collapsed at home, doctors thought he was drunk because he was staggering and slurring his words, but they said he had symptoms brought on by an excess of fluid in the brain. They gave him salt to counteract the effects of the water, but then he died of a heart attack the next day. A man with a shellfish allergy is dead after eating an entree with crab at a restaurant. An autopsy confirms that the 35-year-old man, Rodney Hawkins, went into shock and died after eating the dish at a Ruby Tuesday restaurant. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation says that Hawkins had ordered a chicken dish that contained no shellfish, but was served another chicken dish that contained crab. Now, spokesperson for the restaurant chain says the server's order pad in the kitchen indicates that Hawkins ordered the chicken Oscar, a dish with crab meat. U.S. drivers can expect to shell out more than $4 a gallon on the average for gasoline for the rest of 2008, and prices will keep rising until November. Oil prices, meanwhile, will remain under pressure from the tight market for crude and international demand. Oil dropped somewhat today. Let's see if that keeps up. NASA has tentatively set the final space shuttle mission for May 31st of 2010, 4 months before the shuttle fleet retires. NASA has 10 missions remaining for the shuttle fleet, which President Bush ordered to retire by September 30th of 2010. The schedule announced Monday includes 5 flights this year, 5 in 2009, and 3 in 2010. Arecibo Observatory, the world's largest radio telescope and the source for the SETI at Home data, that some of your computers are tied into faces massive budget cuts that could end its ability to continue the search for life beyond Earth. On the line with us now from the SETI Group, Seth Shostak. Hey, Seth, how are you?
Just fine, George. Good to talk with you.
You too. Now, the situation with Arecibo, you know, because you're online, you're getting the radio telescopes with the Paul Allen array. Do we really need Arecibo to keep looking for the possibility of life out there, Seth?
Well, I think we need Arecibo for that, but not just for that, George, because, you know, Arecibo is the world's biggest antenna. And this is one more instance where bigger really is better because it's far more sensitive than any other radio telescope. So it's useful for a lot of things. SETI at home data, yeah. But also tracking asteroids that otherwise might hit the Earth and ruin your whole day. And also for studying galaxies and pulsars and other things that it's used for.
Now, these massive budget cuts that are planned, what would that do? What would that curtail for Arecibo?
Well, the original idea, which was put forth at the end of 2006 by a National Science Foundation review panel, said, hey, look, we haven't got enough money for everything we want to do in astronomy, and so we're going to cut Arecibo from a $10 million a year budget, more or less, to something more like $4 million a year. And we'll urge them to try and find the additional monies elsewhere to bring that back up to the $10 million they need. Now, if it really went down to $4 million, they just have to take that thing apart, truck it away, and fill up the bowl. I mean, it would shut it down by the year 2011 if they don't find other money.
Now, there's an organization out there called Save Arecibo that would like a couple possible funding bills to get support. Do you recommend people just go online and do whatever they can to get this thing approved?
Yeah, you bet I do. They can find, you know, ways to do this either via the SETI at Home website or the Planetary Society. There are two bills in Congress now. One was introduced by Hillary Clinton. That's a Senate bill. Senate 2862, doesn't matter about the numbers, you can find those online. There's also a House resolution from the Puerto Rican Commissioner, Luis Fortuno, H.R. 3737. Both of these essentially do the same thing. They want to force the National Science Foundation to fully fund Arecibo. And of course, you can say, look, you know, Hillary Clinton is from the state of New York, and Arecibo's run out of Cornell, so, you know, it's not completely if you will, an altruistic move. And, of course, the commissioner from Puerto Rico obviously has a dog in this fight, too. But, you know, forget all that. That's politics. This is something that I think ought to be done. And it's just like when they tried to shut down the Hubble telescope a little too soon. I think the public's input can make a difference.
I think you're right. Seth, thank you so much. Keep us abreast of this, okay?
You got it, George.
Seth Shostak, in a moment, our special guest this hour, Richard Haynes. We're going to talk about the National Aviation Reporting Center on anomalous phenomena. What do pilots see up there in the skies? Richard Haynes is next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Richard Haynes is currently the chief scientist at the National Aviation Reporting Center on anomalous phenomena. Over the years, Dr. Haynes has specialized in citing reports of anomalous phenomena made by pilots and air traffic controllers. His interest began in 1965 during his space-related research for the U.S. manned Gemini flight program when he directed a new NASA laboratory that could accurately simulate the visual appearance of objects in Earth's orbit. Here he is with us now, Richard Haynes. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Well, fine, George. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Likewise, likewise. And I'm going to see you at a conference at the Mutual UFO Network 39th Annual UFO Symposium in San Jose, July 24th through the 27th. So I'm looking forward to meeting you and all the other folks out there.
Well, I am too.
Richard, let's talk a little bit about the organization and National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. Because of all the reports that come in from people, good, credible witnesses, I think reports from pilots and air traffic controllers are some of the best. And tell me about the organization.
Sure. Well, back in the end of 1999, Ted Rowe and I got together and considered how can we do two things. How can we contribute to aviation safety as related to this array of unidentified aerial phenomena and also collect high-quality scientific data? And we decided that what we really need in this country is a reporting center where pilots and air crew and controllers can make their reports confidentially and not jeopardize their career. And so we formed NARCAP back in early 2000, and we've been going strong ever since. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, public benefit scientific organization. We have about right now 37 professionals that are contributing their time and talents. We provide a website and encourage pilots to send in their reports to us, and we can promise confidentiality. And this is, turns out to be really very important. There is such a bias out there against reporting for various reasons that...
Oh, it's huge.
Oh, it's terrible. That the management, the airlines, for instance, and the FAA can validly claim that there's no problem because pilots aren't reporting them. But we know differently.
And what are they reporting, Richard?
Well, they're reporting a very wide range of phenomena, and of course many of them are very prosaic, very understanding, understandable, atmospheric optical effects, re-entry of satellites, astronomical events of various kinds, but there's a residue, we figure approximately 10-15% of all the reports just cannot be identified. They can't be explained away. We would like to, but we just can't do it. And so we're applying scientific principles whenever possible, looking for supportive radar data, photographic data, electromagnetic data from the aircraft, plus the eyewitness testimony, of course, and trying to find out what's going on.
You call these objects unidentified aerial phenomena. Mm-hmm. And have you ever seen one yourself?
No, I haven't, and I think that that's important. I keep looking, by the way. It's not that I'm not looking, but I guess I haven't been fortunate yet. But it's a benefit to me, I think, because it helps me maintain some more objectivity, which I need in order to maintain credibility with the aviation community. And also, I think, to keep my feet on the ground in terms of interpretation, since I don't carry that same bias that... eyewitnesses would carry.
Now, some of the pilots who report, do they sometimes go straight to NARCAP and they bypass their superiors?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's a very, very typical situation. You may remember the O'Hare Airport case back in November of 2006.
Yes.
That's exactly what happened there. I interviewed airline employees the afternoon it happened, and within like a week the company had come down on them and shut them up. And if we'd waited a week, we wouldn't even know about the case.
If you waited a week, you wouldn't know? It would have been gone that quickly?
Well, yes, gosh. They would have covered it up. Maybe cover up's the wrong word. Inhibited public disclosure.
What are some of the most incredible cases you've heard, Richard, from pilots or air traffic controllers?
Well, I don't know how much time you have, but I have over 3,000 cases in my file, which are worldwide, by the way, coming over a very broad range of years. But NARCAP is an American organization. We are interested in foreign cases, but only what we might learn from them from a scientific point of view. But... we have 13 countries affiliated with us from the standpoint that if they would like to set up a NARCAP kind of an organization, we're very happy to help them do that, following the procedures and set up, you know, administrative requirements and so forth, so that they might be more effective in collecting data in their own countries.
Richard, does anybody report, any pilots report being attacked or chased?
Well, I guess the question there, that's a good question. It's how do you define chase or attack? There's a large percentage of the unexplained cases where the airplane is flying along and the phenomenon comes up alongside the airplane, slows down to its speed, paces it for 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, and then departs. That's a very typical incident. And it's hard to explain cases like that on the basis of birds, astronomical events, electrostatic effects, plasma effects. It's something else. The aircraft, I hate to say this, but it sounds to me like the aircraft is the center of attention of the phenomena, which, of course, gets us into deep water in a hurry.
Have we had any reports of missing aircraft because they got too close to these objects?
The answer is yes. There is a very tragic story from Melbourne, Australia, of a young man who went flying in a Cessna after dark over Bass Strait, south of Melbourne. And he got on the radio, and he radioed to the international airport at Melbourne that a strange object was persecuting him. Well, to make a long story short, this was many years ago now, I collected a whole lot of information on that event and analyzed it and wrote up a rather extensive report, which turned into a book, actually. The young man disappeared. He's never been found. No trace of the airplane has ever turned up. He describes it as an object outside his airplane that was chasing him. It was a long shape. It was metallic on the outside. It had green lights on it. And it moved in very odd accelerations, let's say. It would disappear. It would hover above him. He got disoriented, I think. The skeptics claim that he got disoriented and crashed. He was about 4,000 feet altitude at the time. I don't believe that happened, and in my book, Melbourne Episode, gives a lot of arguments why not. So, yes, there have been cases of missing pilots. Another case from Puerto Rico, two gentlemen were flying back from Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico after playing golf, and they got about halfway across the water stretch of water there, about 50 miles across, and reported a very strange object that was persecuting them and causing their compass to deviate. They disappeared. The Coast Guard went into immediate rescue mode and couldn't find them.
Jeez.
It's scary.
Why, again, Richard?
Those are private pilot cases. I don't know of any cases, of course, with large commercial aircraft, thank God.
And for military, we probably don't know, right?
Well, I don't.
No. Why, if these objects are being taken or swallowed up or captured, why?
I don't know. It could be they crashed. But why aren't there any traces, you see? Again, it's an aviation safety issue in a small percentage of the cases. And I think that's an important point to we don't want to alarm the public here. This is not going on every day. But the FAA in Washington has expressed great concern in past years over wind shear, you know what that is.
Yes, that's almost like a huge downdraft.
Yes,
if a plane gets stuck in it, it better fly out of it, right?
It better have plenty of power to get itself out, that's right.
Yep.
And so wind shear has been taken very seriously, and the FAA has required the installation of wind shear detection equipment at certain airports, one of them being Denver, where that occurs once in a while. Well, another concern is bird strikes, where the airplane strikes a bird in flight, and it might cause some damage to the engines or the airplane or both. And the rate of occurrence of a pilot in his career flying along and encountering what you would call a UAP, an unidentified aerial phenomena, is about the same frequency of occurrence as a wind shear encounter. Well, it raises the question, if the FAA is so concerned about wind shear and bird strikes, why isn't it concerned about UAP?
Well, it should, but maybe they just aren't doing it publicly.
Well, I hope so. If they are, they're doing it very privately. There's a snicker factor, as you are well aware.
Of course.
And there has been a documented evidence of certain officials putting out orders to keep quiet, to squelch the information about this particular dimension, which is aviation safety.
Well, and the Snicker factor as well, Richard, let's find out. When you were the senior research scientist with NASA, what did your coworkers say to you while you were working on these studies? We'll be back in a moment. We'll also take phone calls with our guest, Richard Haynes, next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we continue with our UFO extravaganza night. Bill Nell joins us. We're also going to talk about some ghosts with Bill as well. So a full range of paranormal talk for you tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We'll come right back. We'll take phone calls with our guest, Richard Haynes, on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, when you worked for NASA as a senior research scientist, how did your colleagues react to some of your work?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised to find that most of them were very supportive. They would offer actually to give advice and to point me in the direction of some science data that I needed and so forth. Management really came to me and said, we don't really care what you do on your own hours, your off hours. Just make sure that you're not speaking on behalf of the government. And when I assured them that I would do that, there was no problem.
And so as you continued your research and your work, did you find anything else? Did you find that we were withholding information?
No, not really. I have been with NASA since 1964 during the Gemini program, and there's a lot of interesting things coming back from the space program. A lot of it has been written up in books and tabloids and magazine articles. I frankly don't feel that there's that kind of solid scientific support for what the claims that the astronauts have seen truly what you and I would call UAP. The lighting conditions in space are so bizarre, so unusual, people just don't understand, who, of course, hasn't been there, haven't researched it. And so you can be fooled. The eye and the brain can be fooled, and I'm the first to admit that.
So you don't think any of these claims by people that the astronauts may have seen things on the edge of craters on the moon in places like that, that you don't think those things happened?
No.
Okay, let's go to some calls. First time caller line, Larry in Wisconsin. Hi, Larry.
Hi, George. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks.
I listen to you guys all the time. I started out with Art. I just wanted to, I've been kind of wanting to tell you, I've tried to call before. I'm 50 now. When I was 18, I was sitting out in the yard with a big, it was kind of an open field. Late at night, it was about 2 a.m, and I looked up and I saw this light traveling, and I started lighting a lighter, and it was kind of going, you know, across the sky, and then it just made a real sharp downward move, and then it, once again, like a corner, it wasn't a curve or anything, and it came down pretty low, and it seemed like it was doing this, kind of responding to the lighter every time I would light it. And then all of a sudden, it just took off and went over the horizon. And there was this orange, kind of like a flash, almost like a silent explosion. And it always kind of, something I always wanted to tell somebody. But I've never seen anything since then like that.
Well, I don't know. Another one of those cases.
It's almost like it went through some type of field or something. It went so fast when it disappeared that it kind of just like this bright kind of flicker of orange and yellow over the horizon.
Richard, do you get similar cases like this from pilots?
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. Larry, what you've described is really very familiar. I think a lot of people have seen phenomena like that. They're very puzzling. Physicists certainly don't understand what it is, and astronomers don't know what it is, and you don't know what it is, and I don't know what it is. But let's study it. Let's put some science people in Washington, get some scientists and professors together and take a look at it, which they're not doing now. Appreciate the information.
And let's be above board when we study it rather than suppress it and hide it.
Exactly.
west of the Rockies. Raleigh in Utah, you're up with us. Hey, Raleigh.
Yes, I want to know about any sightings before or just after the downing of TWA Flight 800.
Did we have anything like that, Richard, to report?
Oh, boy. That's a loaded question. I guess I would have to pull out a file on TWA 800, which took place in 1996 in July 17th. The answer is yes, there have been quite a number of sightings. I have over 3,000 going back to the beginning of aviation, actually, right up to the present year. I have a feeling that what Raleigh's asking for is something of that magnitude, that devastating accident, for instance. No, I do not. I don't have any cases like that, and I'm very thankful for that. There have been the Egypt Air, which I recall off the coast near Nantucket, I believe it was.
That's the one where they thought they might have had a suicide pilot?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And having looked into that case rather extensively, I don't think at all that's the answer. There was radar contact on board that Egypt Air aircraft with some unknowns ahead of the airplane at their altitude. And there's a possibility, just a small possibility, that the pilot, who was alone in the cockpit at the time, by the way, executed a dive maneuver to avoid the objects.
Jeez.
But, of course, the NTSB hasn't really emphasized that and wants the whole case to go away.
Have there ever been any reports from pilots that scared them so much, Richard, they decided never to fly again?
No, I don't know of any. I have great respect for pilots. These guys are highly motivated, trained, educated. They do a wonderful job. And by and large, they keep their act together, even though there may be something awfully strange right outside the cockpit at altitude and cruise speed. No, I think that they do a wonderful job, and the general public needs to know that.
What do some of the pilots report in terms of the propulsion system or how these objects may have traveled?
Well, that's a great question. That's one of the key questions that we're asking within NARCAP. That many of the pilots, being good witnesses, good technically trained, often military background experiences, they would know what to look for in terms of afterburner colors and brightnesses at night, for instance, and running light colors, navigation lights, anti-collision lights. They will not report seeing anything that comes close to an afterburner, which would be like a turbojet, even a rocket effect. So that I have to say that the pilots are not able to report any kind of propulsion. I have some very interesting cases with magnetic deviation effects on board the compasses, the cockpit compasses. Radio transmission is blocked. Radar is picking up something that the eye doesn't see from time to time. Some very fascinating electromagnetic effects, which can cause aviation safety concern. You don't want these cockpit displays and controls to be malfunctioning, of course. And we have approximately a 5% hit rate on that in our database. Roughly 5% of the cases that are reported by pilots of objects and phenomena they cannot identify are associated with electromagnetic effects in the cockpit.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're up with us. Hello there.
Hi, my name's Ken. I'm so thankful to get through tonight.
Thanks, Ken.
And it's my first time listening and my first time calling. I'm driving. I came across your station. My question is, I'm someone that believes in God. I'm not against UFOs, and I think that there's a possibility of anything being possible. But the point being is that I really need proof and evidence. And with all UFO, with all ghost stories, with all Yeti stories, there's never, ever any proof and evidence. It's always a snapshot that didn't come through. It's always a scientist that was a little quirky. It's always, and again, I'm someone that believes in anything, but I never, in these millions of stories of Yetis, UFOs, and everything, there's never been any direct proof and evidence in any case since the 1940s. It's all speculation, and I'm so into proof and evidence. So I'm asking, is there something with proof and evidence out there that's really, that, you know, 10 scientists will step up and go, that's fact? Or are there just millions of sightings and millions of maybes?
Well, the evidence could very well be eyewitness testimony. We really don't have, we, the public, the hard evidence in terms of, you know, the artifact or, you know, the spent propulsion system or whatever it might have been. We don't have that. But we do have eyewitnesses who are extremely credible, military and the like, who have come public and have talked about the things they see and know. Richard, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with you. We're all asking for the same sort of thing. We'd love to find an ashtray inscribed from Alpha Centauri and so forth. I would be surprised if you could find 10 scientists who you could agree on anything, very frankly. But we do need proof. But if pilots and air traffic controllers, for instance, are discouraged from coming forward with their stories, for whatever reason, good or bad, we're never going to get that proof. And so NARCAP really is a serious organization. We are not a UFO organization. We do not affiliate with any UFO organization, aviation professionals. What we're trying to do is keep our nose to the grindstone and collect the kind of scientific data that we can make a case for a reality here. It's very elusive. It's a new science. It's a new form of science, and new sciences always have trouble getting started.
I wonder if, in the years gone past, if these UFOs captured lunists, for example, in the late 1800s. What do you think?
Well, I haven't studied that, I'm afraid, so I really couldn't comment on it, but I would be surprised. I doubt it.
Let's go to our first-time caller line, Philip in Illinois. Hey, Philip.
Hey, how are you? How you doing?
Good. We're well, thanks.
All right. I have one question and one other thing that doesn't pertain to it, if I could add it in there. In the history of the United States, was there any recorded surveillance or anything about the United, about fighter jets encountering UFOs and engaging them?
Now, we know the Iranians have. How about here, Richard?
Mm-hmm. I don't know of any, but that doesn't mean that there weren't any. It just means that the Air Force may be able to restrict that data.
But we have had reports of the late Gordon Cooper, astronaut, who with his couple other jets spotted UFOs. Not necessarily a dogfight, Philip, but the pilots, military type, have seen these things.
Right, right. I know Mexico has tried to engage them or follow them or chase them down and stuff in the past. I'm looking through the internet.
Uh-huh.
Also, George, can I bother you with one quick question?
Real fast, Philip.
Okay. Where I work third shift, and I do recordings at night to look for ghosts. There's only three of us in the facility, and I recorded a woman screaming twice. I don't know if there's any way I can get that to you, a copy of that, or no.
Can you get me an MP3 via computer?
Yes, I could.
Okay,
yes, I could.
I'll take it.
Awesome, thank you.
All right, I'll look for that. Let's go west. David in Hawaii, you're on Coast to Coast. Hey, David.
Aloha, George.
You too, my friend.
Yeah, nice to have this guest on board. I just got a question for him about plasma. Has there been any sightings that seem to carry like a plasma blue, like a welding arc underneath, round circles about the size of a gallon jar up in the sky, that produces a plasma blue light, like electric blue, almost like a welding bead?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It sounds like something you may have seen. Is that right?
Oh, definitely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, the answer is yes. Blue is a pretty common color that's reported. And you probably realize that the U.S. government does not permit blue lights to be used on airplanes. We're not supposed to use blue lights. So the blue lights have to come from somewhere else.
Red and white strobes on planes, right?
Well, this thing didn't have any strobes. I'm talking, if you take a gallon jar, like a mayonnaise jar cover, and you put it above your head about 6 feet. There were three of these things going east to west over Maui, and they lit up the island of Kahoolawe. This was like about 10:40 at night on the way to Lahaina. And the whole island of Kahoolawe just lit up, all the ocean, acres and acres of water. And they went side by side, two of them first. And then I looked back in the, I was sitting in the back seat, and I looked back to see where they came from. Here comes a third one. And there was no streaming, like, you know, like streaming, any streamer hanging off the back of it. It's just circular lights, and they've, bullets can't fly that fast. I mean, and there was a report the very next morning that lights are seen of that nature flying west to east over over Hilo on the Big Island. And it's like it took a turn and came back over Maui. And I think if you look in the newspaper, in Hawaii News, might maybe like 1978, 79, or early 80, I think there was a report in the newspaper. It just really, I thought about the plasma thing when people started talking about the plasma cannon, you know, and I'm wondering if the plasma cannon that they talk about has anything to do with them. Because well, these things were going so fast.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so maybe if you want to check the island newspaper, maybe.
Thanks, David. Doesn't sound like it. What about radar? Does radar show these things? I remember in the beginning, years ago, my father used to watch like science fiction theater, and they would have film of inside air traffic control, and they'd show radar and little dots, and they didn't know what these were. But what about today, Richard?
Well, there are cases where radar does pick them up and other cases where they don't. O'Hare is a good example. We have a number of eyewitnesses on the ground at O'Hare Airport, Chicago, who looked up and saw a round, metallic, spinning, solid, apparently solid object with a metallic kind of a sheen to it underneath the clouds, hovering. But when we examined the radar data, there's nothing there. And so one of our recommendations to the FAA was that they need to expand their capability in terms of wavelengths to be able to detect the phenomenon that they're not detecting now for in the interest of flight safety. So that's part of the mystery, isn't it? Why we can see something that radar can't and vice versa.
East of the Rockies, Glenn in Wisconsin. A couple minutes for you, Glenn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you talk about these metallic objects that have been seen. What is the, like, generally the size of these metallic objects that people are seeing? You know, like, are they extremely large, or, you know, size of a car, or, you know, what's the general size of these?
Well, they have ranged from about 30 feet in diameter to almost as big as a mile. Richard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Glenn, I agree with George on that. We have some very well-documented pilot cases of objects which are generally spherical. They're round, like a ball, but they're only like 2 or 3 feet in diameter. Polished metal sphere, like a ball bearing, for instance, tracking a B-52 bomber at 40-some thousand feet for over a half hour and keeping, you know, a station with the aircraft. Objects that go up in size to a football field or larger, we don't know they're metal. They happen to look like metal, but that doesn't mean they are metal construction. They just appear like metal. So the size is really very large range. The shape can vary. Most of them are non-aerodynamic. They're, in other words, a lot of drag if you're into aerodynamics. A lot of shapes that shouldn't be able to fly. Let's put it that way.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you for the great information, and look forward to hearing about your presentation at the UFO Symposium in San Jose, California. Should be fascinating stuff, my friend.
Well, thank you, George. I'll look forward to seeing you there.
Okay, absolutely. And we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we continue with our paranormal extravaganza tonight. We'll be back.